So you're in PC world then, and you're there because you want to buy a new computer, and two have caught your eye, and you're trying to work out then why one of them is quite a bit more expensive than the other. And so you ask a shop assistant, what is it about this computer that makes it so superior to that computer? And he tells you, and he bombards you then with a whole load of jargon. And if your competence in this area is about as limited as my competence in this area is, then it all just sounds like gobbledygook to you. And you might smile and nod in a knowing way as he talks, but inwardly you're thinking, look, I'm afraid I don't understand how all of that you're saying makes this computer superior to that computer. Now, the writer to the Hebrews then has been talking about how great Jesus is as our high priest. And three times he has referred to Jesus as a priest after the order of Melchizedek. He has used that phrase, a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And he has implied then that that detail is not incidental to the greatness of Jesus as our high priest, but rather it's a big part of what makes him so great and what makes him so superior to all other priests. And as you listen then to this writer talking like that, you may well feel like you're there in PC world listening to that shop assistant. I mean, a priest after the order of Melchizedek. What's all that about? It sounds perhaps to many of us a bit like gobbledygook. And we might smile and nod in a knowing way as we listen to Hebrews being read, but inwardly perhaps we're thinking, look, I'm afraid I just don't understand why that makes Jesus so superior. And in fact, it's not only, is it, that this Melchizedek priesthood, whatever that means, it's not only that that is a bit obscure and a bit unclear, but we might well also think, well, is it not even a bit dubious? Because after all, we know that prominent within the Bible is another priesthood, the priesthood exercised by the tribe of Levi. If you just know roughly your Old Testament, you will know about that very prominent priesthood exercised by an Israelite tribe, the tribe of Levi. And so we might feel then that this writer of this book is actually one step worse than that shop assistant at PC World. Not only is he talking gobbledygook, but it's misleading, heretical gobbledygook at that. Not only is he focusing on some unfamiliar, unintelligible priesthood, but he's focusing on that priesthood instead of the proper, conventional priesthood that we are all more familiar with. That's what we might feel. And that's why this passage that we've come to this morning is important. Because here at last then our writer addresses this matter head on. He's dropped in these references, as I say, to a priest after the order of Melchizedek. But he hasn't really explained what that means. Here at last he addresses that issue head on. Here at last he explains why it's such a positive thing that Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Here at last he spells out why this Melchizedek priesthood, for all that it might appear to be obscure and even dubious, why, in fact, it is the best possible priesthood. And in that connection then, three things. First of all, it's a priesthood that impressed the greats. It's a priesthood that impressed the greats. So Melchizedek then, well, he was a real man. And you'll notice then that in verse 1, our writer places Melchizedek in his historical context. He was this priest, and on one occasion then, we are told, he met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings. Now, it doesn't really matter to us this morning why Abraham had been slaughtering kings. You can read about that in Genesis 14. We simply need to know then that Abraham here was on his way back from a battle with some kings, and he had this encounter with this priest of God, Most High, that's the real God, the living and true God, and this priest was called Melchizedek. Now, our writer's treatment then of Melchizedek really contains two main emphases. One of those we'll come to later under our second heading, but the other main emphasis is this, that in this encounter between Abraham and Melchizedek, Abraham gave Melchizedek a tithe, that is a tenth of the spoils of this battle that he had just fought. It's mentioned in verse 2, to him, Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything, and then, of course, it dominates verses 4 to 10. So it really is a key emphasis here. And the point then is a very simple one. The point is that this priesthood impressed great Abraham. Abraham didn't say, I'm not too sure about you, Melchizedek, because, you know, I'm going to have a great grandson one day called Levi, and priesthood is the prerogative of him and of his descendants, and that means, my friend, that you must be something of an imposter. He doesn't say that to Melchizedek. No, he digs deep, and he gives to Melchizedek a tenth of the spoils of this battle. In fact, our writer says in verses 9 and 10, precisely because Levi was Abraham's great-grandson, there's a sense in which he too gave this tithe to Melchizedek on this occasion. Now, we Western individualists struggle with the logic of this, I guess, but it's very clear in the Bible that a person can act on behalf of their progeny. In fact, is that not the background to the entire Christian gospel? Why is the Christian gospel needed? What is the basic problem which the Christian gospel addresses? Well, it's this problem, that Adam in the Garden of Eden acted on behalf of his progeny, so that when he disobeyed, we all disobeyed God there on that fateful day in Eden. And on that basis then, because we were there in a sense with Adam disobeying God, on that basis we are all liable to the same eternal punishment as Adam. And I'm saying then that verses 9 and 10 here have an example of that way of thinking. It's, I guess, a less momentous one than the example I've just used of Adam, but it's the same logic, the same way of thinking. Through his ancestor, Levi himself gave this tithe to Melchizedek. But Abraham, then, was one great figure who was impressed by this Melchizedek priesthood. And then our writer implies another great figure who was also impressed by the Melchizedek priesthood. Now, this other figure isn't mentioned by name in our passage, but one of his compositions is quoted. I'm talking about David, because, of course, this phrase, a priest after the order of Melchizedek, where does that come from? It doesn't come from Genesis 14 and that Abraham story. It comes from the book of Psalms. It comes from Psalm 110. And Psalm 110, then, is a psalm of David. It's a very clearly messianic psalm. You know, you remember how it begins. The Lord, that's the Lord in block capitals, Yahweh. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Who on earth is this person whom David addresses as my Lord, and yet is distinct in some sense from Yahweh? Well, it can only be the Messiah, Psalm 110 is a messianic psalm. It's looking forward to this great figure who's to come. And presumably that great figure is still in view when you come to verse 4 of Psalm 110, where we read, "The Lord," that's Yahweh again, "has sworn and will not change his mind. You," presumably the same Messiah, "you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." So Psalm 110 then, in Psalm 110, David is saying that the Messiah, as well as being a king who conquers his enemies, that's a major theme of the psalm, he will also be a priest, but specifically a Melchizedek-style priest. And our author here then, in verse 11, is, I think, presupposing that verse in Psalm 110. And he's really commenting on how remarkable that verse in Psalm 110 is. Because the priesthood that you would expect David to mention then, the Levitical priesthood, as he puts it there, that is the priesthood of Levi's descendants, and specifically the high priestly line of Aaron, which was a subset of the tribe of Levi, that priesthood is completely overlooked by David there in that verse. Just completely overlooks it. The Levitical priesthood might have been dominant at the time of David. It might have had all the force of the law of Sinai behind it. David himself might have fastidiously upheld it in his daily practice of worship in Israel. But nonetheless, as he looks forward to this future Messiah, he doesn't talk in terms of the Levitical priesthood. He looks outside of that priesthood to this other priesthood, this Melchizedek priesthood. And so this is the first thing then that our writer is saying as he promotes to his readers the Melchizedek priesthood. It might seem a bit obscure and a bit weird, but the first thing our writer is saying is, look, it's a priesthood that impressed the greats. It impressed Abraham, and it impressed David. Abraham gave a tithe to Melchizedek. David looked forward to a Messiah who would be like Melchizedek. So that's the first thing. It's a priesthood that impressed the greats. But then secondly, it's a priesthood that changes the game. It's a priesthood that changes the game. Why then were these great figures so impressed by this Melchizedek priesthood? Why didn't Abraham say to Melchizedek, look, I'm not giving a tithe to you, Mr. Melchizedek. The real priests are still in my loins. You're a charlatan. Why didn't David write of a future Messiah after the order of Levi or after the order of Aaron? Why, for these eminent men, was the Melchizedek priesthood a superior priesthood? Well, think about it this way. Reach your hand, as it were, into the middle of Old Testament history somewhere, and just pull out then an Israelite priest. Just a random Israelite priest, just an ordinary Israelite priest who's beavering away there in the tabernacle or there in the temple, depending which part of Old Testament history it is. Pull that Israelite priest out and ask of that man this question. On what basis does he serve as a priest? What qualifies that man to serve as a priest? Well, that simple question yields a simple answer, which is this. That man that you've pulled out randomly, that priest, he belongs to the tribe of Levi. And that, then, is what qualifies him to serve as a priest. Now put that man back where he came from and turn your attention again to Melchizedek. And ask regarding Melchizedek, then, the same question. On what basis does Melchizedek serve as a priest? What qualifies him to serve as a priest? Well, obviously, in his case, the answer can't be he belongs to the tribe of Levi, because the tribe of Levi doesn't yet exist. But the answer could potentially be analogous to the answer in the case of an Israelite priest. It could at least relate to something in Melchizedek's tribal or ethnic identity. He serves as a priest because he belongs to this constituency, because he hails from this people, because he has this blood running through his veins. It could be some genealogical detail that qualifies Melchizedek to serve as a priest, so that his qualification at least parallels to some degree that random Israelite priest qualification. But no, in the case of Melchizedek, his qualification is completely different. And this is where we come then to the other main emphasis. Remember I said there were two main emphases in our writer's treatment of Melchizedek. Number one, he gives this tie to Abraham. He really labours that point. But there's another emphasis, and it's the one we find in verse 3. Of Melchizedek, he says, he is without father or mother, or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. And then he sums up at the end, he continues a priest forever. And this resurfaces in verse 8, doesn't it? Where he's described there as one of whom it is testified that he lives. And that doesn't perhaps seem very remarkable, very dramatic, until you notice what he's contrasting that with there in verse 8. He's contrasting that with mortal men. There are mortal men on the one hand, and then there's Melchizedek, who lives. He's not mortal. He's immortal. And so what qualifies Melchizedek then to serve as a priest is the fact that he can do so unendingly. He has an unending priesthood, a priesthood which will not at some point terminate in death. And clearly that's what David has in mind then, as he looks forward to this Messiah who will be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Look at verse 17, where the writer quotes then from Psalm 110, it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek. And so this then is what so impressed these great figures of the Old Testament about Melchizedek priesthood. That it's unending. It's a priesthood that is invulnerable to death. And you can see then what I mean by this phrase, it's a priesthood that changes the game. We use that phrase, don't we? Something being a game changer. It's quite a popular phrase in our modern society. We use it then when something undergoes a change which actually alters the way in which that thing works. So it's part of the appeal, I guess, isn't it, of Jeremy Corbyn that we've seen in recent weeks. That he's cultivating this perception, at least, that when you vote for me, it's not simply one leader over against another leader, or one party over against another party, but it's voting for a change in the way that politics works. That's what he's saying. It won't be put back in the box where it was before, that phrase he's been using. He's trying to say then that I'm a game changer. I'm changing the very rules, the very structure by which British politics works. And look at verses 15 and 16 then of our passage. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. So you see, there were these ordinary Israelite priests, and they served as priests because they were in the tribe of Levi. Melchizedek, on the other hand, with him it's not just that he's from a different tribe, which itself would be quite radical, But the point is that tribal identity is no longer the criterion at all. No, it's the criterion is way more spectacular with Melchizedek priesthood. It's not about tribal or ethnic or blood identity. It's about being able to serve as a priest forever. That's the qualification. Now, at this point then, it's important to go a bit further and to note this. I had that little illustration then a moment ago about just reaching your hand into Old Testament history and pulling out a random Israelite priest. And of course, there were hundreds of them, weren't there? There were always priests on the conveyor belts of the tribe of Levi. And throughout Old Testament history then, we only know the names of very few then. There were hundreds and hundreds of Levitical priests who served that role. When it comes to the Melchizedek priesthood, there are only actually two priests who come into that category. And one then is Melchizedek, and the other is Jesus, whom our writer keeps saying is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. But we need to be clear then that Melchizedek and Jesus are not two equal priests. And this is why there's a phrase that's very important in verse 3, which I omitted when I read the verse a moment ago. He is without father or mother or genealogy, this is Melchizedek, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues forever. Now that's an interesting, an odd phrase, isn't it? Because, of course, Melchizedek comes before the Son of God, before Jesus, and so you'd have thought it would be that Jesus resembles Melchizedek. But no, the writer says that Melchizedek resembles Jesus. And you could actually translate that as being more dynamic, as though he was actually appointed to resemble the Son of God. And that's the point then, that Melchizedek was a picture, a type, to use that word again that we've used quite often in this series, a type of Jesus. Now, Melchizedek didn't really have an unending priesthood. Melchizedek was an ordinary human being just like you and me. Melchizedek was born, Melchizedek died. The point is that when you read the book of Genesis, he just seems a bit odd. He stands out because Genesis is a book obsessed with genealogies. Any of you who have read Genesis will know that. It's full of genealogies. So-and-so begat so-and-so, and they begat so-and-so. We'll encounter one, God willing, in our passage this evening. And virtually everyone in Genesis is linked to others, to ancestors and to descendants. But then you come to Melchizedek, and there's no mention of who his parents were and who his children were. No mention of his birth and of his death. And so, as one of the commentators says, the account of Melchizedek, it evokes the notion of eternity. That's the point. It just has this feel of a man who just kind of appears from nowhere and disappears into nowhere. This man who just doesn't seem to have any roots and any origins, this kind of mysterious figure. He's a real human being, he's a normal human being, but the way he appears in the text, compared to everyone else in Genesis, he just seems like he's an eternal kind of figure. And he serves then, and indeed this verse seems to be saying, was put on planet Earth precisely for this purpose. He serves as a type, as a little miniature, a little model of Jesus, who really does have an unending priesthood. He's the real Melchizedek. He's the real priest whose priesthood is not terminated by death. You notice that there's, I think, a double entendre in verses 11 and 15, where we have that word arise used. What further need would, verse 11, would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek? Again, verse 15, another priest arises. And at one level then, the word arise there is being used in the sense of emerge. Emerge onto the scene of history, if you like. But at a deeper level, it's the word that is used often in the New Testament for rising from the dead. And it's almost certainly, I think, it almost certainly has that connotation also here, that Jesus would arise from the dead. And having risen from the dead, as we read in verse 16, in the power of an indestructible life, would have this eternal priesthood. He will never die. His priesthood now will never be terminated in death. So, it's a priesthood that impressed the greats. Why did it impress the greats? Because it's a priesthood that changes the game. Whereas other priests were priests on the basis of their tribal identity. Melchizedek in a shadowy form, and Jesus properly and truly is a priest on the basis of an indestructible life. A priesthood that doesn't end. A priesthood that isn't a confined career with a beginning and an end, but a priesthood that just continues and continues as long as it needs to continue. A priesthood that changes the game. But then thirdly and finally, it's a priesthood that achieves the goal. It's a priesthood that achieves the goal. Because notice then that we have in our passage that word again, which we've encountered once or twice before in Hebrews, that word perfection, particularly verse 11. If perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, ... And really then, we've said before, what this word perfecting, perfection, normally means in Hebrews isn't, strictly speaking, moral perfection, though sometimes that connotation is there, but it's completeness. And the point then in verse 11 is that completeness, or actually achieving the goal for which it existed, was not attained by the Levitical priesthood. So all those priests that kept coming forth from the tribe of Levi, in all of that priesthood, year after year, decade after decade, century after century, that priesthood wasn't actually fulfilling the terms of its existence. It wasn't actually achieving the goal. Whereas this Melchizedek priesthood, the priesthood of the great Melchizedek, Jesus Christ, it achieves the goal. And what is that goal? Well, we have it in verse 19. Verse 18, we read then that the former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness. The law made nothing perfect. And the point there, by the way, in this repeated emphasis on the law being set aside, is that with the weakness and the uselessness of the Levitical priesthoods, of the Levitical priesthood, went the uselessness of the Old Testament law generally, because the priesthood didn't stand by itself. Along with the priesthood, there were the sacrifices, and there was the whole tabernacle building, and there was the annual calendar with the Day of Atonement and everything. All these things were joined together. And so if there's a different priesthood, if it's Jesus' priesthood that matters, not the priesthood of those Levites, then all that other stuff, the animal sacrifices themselves and the building and the annual calendar and all that, has to go as well. That's the point he's making there. But then verse 19, he says, on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. And so he's saying then that this priesthood of the great Melchizedek, Jesus, it achieves two things. It, first of all, enables hope. A better hope is introduced. And this is just bringing us back to where we finished last week. Remember, we were talking about hope last week. and our hope then in that eternal future that God has lined up for us. We said that our maturity depends on the degree of our hope. We will only be as mature as Christians as our hope is strong. And remember then that that hope, on what does it rest? It rests on God's promises, certainly, promises which he has sworn with an oath. But we said at the end, it rests too on the fact of Jesus, our high priest. And we've come back to that now in verse 19. Because Jesus is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, because he's this undying high priest, we can have hope in that eternal future. Perhaps you've had the experience of someone who influenced you greatly in your Christian life, perhaps a parent, perhaps a pastor, perhaps a friend, and they died. And obviously that was a hard and a difficult thing, and you miss subsequently the input and the influence of that Christian who had affected you so much over the years. But you've still continued as a Christian. It hasn't in any way imperiled or jeopardized your actual Christian existence. If, however, our high priest were to die, then we would be done. We'd be finished. There would be no hope anymore. There'd be no future glory anymore. But our writer is saying, because he's this kind of priest, not a Levitical priest, they died, but because he's a Melchizedek priest, he's not going to die. Yes, he died once in order to atone for sins, but he's not going to die now. He will live forever as our priest. And we needn't worry, therefore, that we're one day going to read in the births, marriages and deaths column of our newspaper that our high priest has died and his funeral is coming up. No, he will live forever, and we, therefore, can hope solidly in that eternal future that's lined up for us. For so many people around us, the ultimate tragedy is them dying. That's the nightmare prospect for them. The thing that they will hardly ever talk about. The thing that they try to brush under the carpet constantly, that is the great nightmare, the great tragedy, that one day they will die. For us as believers, there's only one ultimate nightmare prospect, and that's Jesus dying. That's our high priest who is there in heaven, somehow falling away from being high priest anymore. And the writer is saying that can't happen. He's a Melchizedek sort of priest, not a Levitical one. He will keep on living and be there for us as long as we need him to be there for us. And therefore we can face the prospect of our own death. That's not a tragedy for us, because we have this hope beyond, as long as he doesn't die. And he can't die because he's in this category of priesthood. And so, this morning, if you're a believer, know that your eternal future is safe and secure and inalienable. It's untouchable. It cannot unravel. It cannot fail to materialize. Because you have an unending, undying priest who will not one day have a heart attack, who will not one day be struck down with some terrible disease, who will not one day go into retirement, but who will be there for you, doing his priestly work as long as you need him to be. So, this priest Jesus, he achieves the goal because he enables hope, but then secondly, he enables access through which we draw near to God. Isn't that an amazing thing when you think about it? We come across this kind of language all the time. We use it often about drawing near to God. But think about it. We today have come here, and we may be sitting in a very ordinary building, in an ordinary part of an ordinary city, within this world. But we have been drawing near to God. And think about who we are and where we have been this past week, where we have been in our thoughts, the sort of words we have spoken, the sort of attitudes we have harbored, how sinful and messed up we have been at points this week, perhaps how messed up we have been in the first hours of this very day. And yet here we are drawing near to this God who is so holy that the angels cover themselves in his presence. How is that possible? It's possible because we have a Melchizedek kind of priest. It's not possible through some son of Aaron, some descendant of Levi. But it's possible because our priest is the Melchizedek type of priest. And in our utter unworthiness, and in our utter messed upness, we can enter the courts of heaven. We can approach God. In our work situations, when we're struggling, we can take a moment aside and cry out to God, and in that moment we're drawing near to the throne of the Almighty, the Holy One. And we can do that. And we can do that because we have a Melchizedek kind of priest. So this is not jargon. This is not some technical, impenetrable argument that's irrelevant to us this morning that this writer is making. No, this has profound implications. He's pointing to a priesthood that achieves the goal of priesthood. Because of Jesus, we can have firm hope in an eternal future this morning. And because of Jesus, our Melchizedek priest, we can approach the very presence of God. Amen.